This is Morgan Michael, welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness, together by challenging our assumptions and venturing beyond the status quo in education. We can make a big impact, one small act at a time.
When we see behavior that's unexpected or undesirable in our classrooms and by extension our lives, this is not just young person specific, that we can take a compassionate, non-judgmental lens to that and start asking questions. Stuart Shanker's question fits so beautifully here. Why now? And start trying to find ways to address whatever is being communicated. Oftentimes it's a stressor or an unmet need. And so that's one of the key concepts that we talk about that can be really a game changer for a lot of people. And a lot of our adult students are parents and they're in relationships. And during the 10 months they're with us as students, they are seeing a big difference in how they're just interacting with their family members and with their friends. And that's really exciting.
Have you ever wondered which small shifts in your classroom practice could make the most impact? In part one of my interview with inclusion coach Kristen Weens, we discuss the transformative and creative use of visuals in the classroom, including specific tips and tricks for amping up your effectiveness in the classroom. We talk about what an inclusion coach's role involves and what educators need now more than ever. We touch on the fact that EAs are the unsung heroes in education and Kristen's educational assistant groundbreaking training program. Finally, we explore the importance of developing unconditional, positive regard for those that we serve in the classroom and community, but most importantly, how to foster self-compassion for ourselves. Kristen is the Special Education Inclusion Coach at School District 62 in Victoria, BC, Canada. Passionate about inclusion, visuals, UDL, self-reg, mindfulness, and creativity, she touches lives everywhere. She is also a speaker and the author of My Gratitude Jar. In our second part of this interview, we focus on her work with activist and musician Rafi, talking about the 9 principles of child honoring and exploring their collaborative online course. We highlight her beautiful book, The Gratitude Jar. You won't want to miss that conversation. Please see the show notes for links to her amazing free visuals and her gratitude jar reading at northstarpaths.com. You can follow Kristen on Twitter at kweens62 or on Instagram at kristen.weens. Hi, Kristen Weens. Thank you so much for joining me today on Kindsight 101. I'm really excited for our conversation.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to chat with you.
You have done so much for educators and you have quite an incredible following, people who really love all of the things that you're doing and get a lot of guidance, I think, from your work. Can you first speak about your role as an inclusion coach within your own district and what that really means to be that?
Sure. So when I started with the district, we were titled curriculum coordinators, and that certainly was a term that people were probably more familiar with. But as inclusion became more and more embedded in all of our educational settings, we found that we were really moving towards supporting educators in how they were implementing inclusion. And our role was more that word supporting, that we were coming alongside and supporting them in their journey rather than, and I know curriculum coordinators don't necessarily just do a hand over the curriculum, but we found that the name wasn't quite reflecting what we were hoping our role would be. And so we liked the feel really of inclusion coach, that we wanted to be there to support and coach people along on their journey. And so we made the decision to switch to inclusion coach. So I had the great privilege of being able to go into schools and classrooms from K to 12 and just help people find creative solutions and inspiration and really just that encouragement piece. Oftentimes it's, I think you'll know that educators can be very hard on themselves, and And even just going in and really expressing gratitude for the work they're doing, encouragement that they're on the right track. And lately, for me, it's been really an encouragement of incorporating some more self-compassion in their practices as they do the incredible work they're doing. So it's a real honor to go in and out of classrooms and schools. So that's a little bit about Inclusion Coach. And out of that, actually, to tie it into some of the work that maybe people outside of the district will know me for, we have a shortage here, and I think many people have shortages of educational assistants in the school systems. And so part of my role as an inclusion coach, I was given the green light to create an EA training program, which has just been an incredible joy and privilege for me. And so that really, I mean, made me have to reflect on what do I believe and what are the resources that I really want to highlight for people. And so out of that teaching, I started creating graphics. I'm a strong believer in visuals and realized I was talking a lot about these things and that my adult students would benefit from visuals as much as our young people would. And so that's how the graphics that a lot of people know me for my graphics, and that work came out of the educational training program. And so it's been just a privilege to walk along the journey of these adult learners as they learn more about inclusion and how to support it in our schools.
Wonderful. And when I think about your visuals, I think about your inclusion ABCs or your Stuart Shanker's self-regulation strategies or some of the child honoring or even the Shelley Moore. I know you're connected to her as well. And she's a real,
love her work.
Yeah, she's a real leader in what it means to be inclusive. And she has those 5 more minutes videos and all of that. Tell me more about this training program, because I think these educational assistants are often taken, maybe not taken for granted, but I mean, their skill set has to be so incredibly developed. And how do you even approach a training program where, I mean, these EAs are working with some of the most interesting and challenging students, right? And they're one-on-one often. And so what are some of the elements that you like to reinforce in that training program? What do you touch on in terms of how does someone in that work demonstrate self-care? How do they show up for those kids in an inclusive and unjudgmental way? I'd love to know a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, to highlight your point, they often are the unsung heroes in this inclusion movement and in our school system. And so that's part of the joy that we have. We bring in a lot of our EAs who are working in the field and ask them to come and present to our students. And so it's a nice opportunity to show appreciation and really honor the skill sets that they have that they're bringing into our school. So that's a great part of it. As far as content, it's been such a great journey for me to really have to become quite clear on what I believe. So some of the key concepts, this idea that behavior is communication. When we see behavior that's unexpected or undesirable in our classrooms and by extension our lives, this is not just young person specific, that we can take a compassionate, non-judgmental lens to that and start asking questions. Stuart Shanker's question fits so beautifully here. Why now? And start trying to find ways to address whatever is being communicated. Oftentimes it's a stressor or an unmet need. And so that's one of the key kind of concepts that we talk about that can be really a game changer for a lot of people. And a lot of our adult students are parents and they're in relationships. And during the 10 months they're with us as students, they are seeing a big difference in how they are just interacting with their family members and with their friends. And that's really exciting because, I mean, that's that deep, sticky learning, right? You know that when they're talking about it that way, that it's going to stay with them and they'll bring it into our schools. When we always say it's easy in our classroom to talk about these things, and it's much more difficult when you're face-to-face with a dysregulated young person who's really struggling. And so it's great when we see that concept of behavior as communication really sinking in. Self-regulation is a big part of our curriculum, and we rely heavily on Stuart Shanker's work with the Merit Center and his self-reg work. So they're such great resources to turn to. And just that idea that the triune brain and how we know so much about the brain now, and it can allow us to stay calm in the face of someone who is dysregulated. And what we're seeing is a lot more compassion at that point.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because some of the professional development work that I've been doing focuses on the triune brain. I had Stuart Shanker on the podcast, and he was so eloquent in describing how that shows up. The way that he described it just really made the whole concept come to life and how it translates to the fight, flight, and freeze. Mm-hmm. And I think for educators, I see this too. I see the light bulb go on and go, oh my gosh, it takes it away from the personalization of the behavior too. I think oftentimes, whether we mean to or not, we sort of own the behaviors that happen in the classroom as our own or as our own fault. Mm-hmm. And I think that whole idea of self-compassion is so important because there's a lot of judgment in education. You know, is your class obedient? You know, sort of being this underlying evaluative measure. And really what all of this work uncovers is that we are all imperfect. We're all trying to figure this out. And it is not necessarily a reflection of you directly that this behavior is coming out. It's a problem to solve, right? And so it's a way to sort of distance yourself personally from it. And I think educators are burning out all the time. And that's a really, really important message.
Yeah, it's interesting because we talk a lot in our course also about unconditional positive regard, which is more of a term from psychology, but we bring it into our conversations. And we start with, what does that look like for a student, especially a dysregulated student, because that's when it's hardest, like you say, to not take it personally or not to blame. Mm-hmm. And so that's an important component of it. But then we extend it even further to say, you know, unconditional positive regard starts with the regard you offer yourself. And that's where that self-compassion comes in. And yeah, and I know you've had that conversation with Jodi Carrington too. And I love her work. And again, I'm drawn to all of this brain-based evidence that we're seeing and the philosophies and strategies that come from that. And so that's Stuart Shanker and that's Jodi's work and Dan Siegel. All of that work is, I find, really encouraging and really encouraging that we have people that are able to be so articulate and clear about what that means. And I think when we understand more, we can change the way that we interact with young people and with each other.
Yes. I do want to talk a little bit about some practical shifts because I think it's so important to have the philosophical discussion because I think that's the foundation through which we can act. But that said, I think sometimes there's just little actionable shifts that we can make in our practice that can have quite incredible results. I want to ask you, what are some of the ways that through your coaching or just some of the, I mean, you get to see all of these different classes firsthand. What are some little shifts that educators have made in their classroom or in the interactions with their students that have set their classroom, their students up for success?
The first thing that pops to my mind, and this won't be a surprise for a lot of people, is the idea of incorporating more visuals. And it's quite a simple concept, and I've seen some really profound positive impacts from that ability. I think as educators, there's just so much that we would benefit from knowing in so many different fields, and we only have so much time in our pre-service years, and we have content and all sorts of things to tackle. And one of the things I love about my job as an inclusion coach is that we work in teams and we work with our speech and language people, our psychologists, our occupational therapists, and the amount that I've learned in the last 12 years being in the district office has been just incredible. It feels like a university education. And so I get really excited. The work around visuals was heavily, heavily influenced by the speech and language and people in our district and the occupational therapists. And seeing how they use it and seeing the results just made me really passionate about it. So this idea that there are kids struggling with either diagnosed or undiagnosed language processing issues in our classrooms. And then even Stuart's work, like as soon as we add any level of stressors onto our students or ourselves, the ability to process language decreases. It's just not there for us. And so this idea of visuals being a permanent and more accessible way of communication, especially when kids are dysregulated, was powerful for me and just one that I've run with. There's a, I'm going to forget his name, a 13-year-old boy from Japan who wrote a book called The Reason I Jump, an autistic young person, and he talks about visuals and he says, words have wings and visuals are anchors. And I think that sums it up so well, that idea that a young person who's dysregulated, one of the things when we flip our lids, as Dan Siegel says, that is offline is that ability to process language. And unfortunately, and I'm definitely one of them, when I'm in a situation with someone who's dysregulated, my tendency is to talk more.
Yeah.
I tend to just start filling in with very nice, kind, compassionate language. It's still language. And so I've had to really focus on kind of taking that breath and realizing that I need to reduce the amount of language that I have. And then that if available, being able to introduce some visuals. And that's why, especially with visuals, it's really important if you're going to have a big impact, is that you're doing it proactively so that you have the visuals available for you and ready. We can do a lot to avoid dysregulation by having some visuals in place, because a lot of kids are dysregulated because they don't understand what's being asked for them, or they're confused, or they're frustrated. And so even simple ideas like, what does lining up for the library look like? Are there little footprints on the ground where you're to stand? Is there a list of the three things that need to happen to get ready to go to the library? And then for some of our kids who struggle more with dysregulation, do you have a comfort kit that has some visual ideas of what you can do when you're starting to flip your lid? And so, it won't be a surprise to you, I'm a big supporter of visuals, and learning more about that and just starting small and introducing little bits, little steps into your classroom and in your schools. And certainly most of the schools that I am supporting, well, all of the schools in my district, but even the schools that I see as I travel to other districts, have speech and language pathologists and OTs available, at least on a consult basis. And so reach out to them. I have found that those professions are just so eager to help and to also support teachers in implementing visuals in their classroom.
That's so great. And I think what you highlight too is behind the visual is essentially an explicit explanation or teaching about a particular classroom behavior that we're expecting. So this assumption that kids simply know how to line up, it is an assumption. And so we have to sort of step into this place of empathy and openness where we go, is it possible that our students may not actually know or be able to follow those instructions that we give verbally, or that we assume that they have because they've done it before or whatever? Like, sometimes we have to be so very explicit about some of those classroom procedures. And I know with scheduling, that's one that many educators have already adapted to and will use visuals for schedules. But I like that you're talking about the visuals behind procedure as well. Are there any other examples for visuals or situations where you've seen visuals really being of use that maybe might be a twist on what a teacher would normally think of when they think of visuals?
Well, one of the things I often say is, if you find yourself repeating anything in your classroom, that's a good place to start. If you're tired of hearing your own voice say something, think about if there's a way that you could put that into a visual. And one that comes to mind is, oftentimes we'll see, I mean, all ages, but I think of little ones who haven't quite got a solid understanding on this concept of time, which again is a very abstract idea, but that, when is this? When is this? Are we done? How long? And what's coming next? And so, again, like you say, a classroom schedule, but then also perhaps an individual schedule can be very helpful and very empowering to a young person. And even many students, you have the classroom schedule, which I love to see, but that can be very overwhelming. If you have the entire day there, for a little person, that can be a lot to take in. And even finding where we are on a schedule can be difficult. So even adaptations like having an arrow that goes down beside your visual schedule so you know where you are, or removing the things that have been done. And even the idea of just bringing it down to two things. So you might have your whole class visual schedule and then having a first then, so that if you want to just look up what are we doing now and what's next, that little chunk of information is available within that bigger context. If you want to know if you have PE today and you can look down the whole list, that's great. But if a lot of kids are just wanting to know, what am I supposed to be doing now and what's next? Mm. And so that idea of chunking that we know in and we bring into lots of our other practices can be applied to our visual schedule. And then coupled with that too, for a lot of students, again, that concept of time, having a visual timer, a time timer, I've seen a lot of teachers just love that as an addition. We, as inclusion coaches, a number of years ago, we put together what we called Kindy Kits, and it was a bucket of resources and strategies that we would give to our kindergarten teachers, which we've now expanded, actually, and we call them transition kits, and it's not just for kindergarten teachers. Mm-hmm. But in there was a visual timer, a time timer. And I had we had a kindergarten teacher who had been in our district for 30 years write us a lovely note, and I use it in my presentations. And she says, I've been a kindergarten teacher 30 years, and I have no idea how I did it without a time timer. Well, that's a powerful endorsement.
Yes. Yes. And I think that's why I asked the question, because I think we think of visuals maybe in a traditional sense, and mm-hmm. really where they're so useful is in the ways that maybe we've never used them before. And I think sometimes it comes from that exploration of what are other people doing in their classrooms, or what has been successful. Mm-hmm. And so much of the hesitation or reticence of having that conversation is sort of coming from this place of vulnerability, going, God, I should know this. I've been in this game for 15 years. How am I still struggling? Or how is this particular student having so much difficulty? And it's hard to admit. And I think that that culture can be really tricky in schools, this idea that we sort of have to have it all figured out.
Yeah. And I mean, the more I learn about education, the more I know I don't know. There's just always so much to learn, and we can learn from each other so much more efficiently than we can alone. I think that's also something I'm really grateful for my role is, yeah, I come in to try to offer support to other staff members, but ultimately I'm learning so much more from them while I'm in there. And then I say, I have very few of my own ideas, but I'm really good at sharing other people's ideas. And so this position has allowed me an opportunity to just see incredible practices in action.
Beautiful. Thank you for that. Thank you for those tips too, because I think just little nuggets can jog somebody's inspiration and imagination as well. I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating a kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gain from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag smallactbigimpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.